All right. So, call the meeting of the Special House Committee on Energy to order. Today is Tuesday, April 11th. Time is now 10:18 a.m. And nobody can hear me, so we'll do it all over again. Now that everybody can hear me, I'm calling the meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Today is Tuesday, April 11th. I started the meeting at 10:18 a.m. We're joined by Representative Carrick, Representative Wright, Representative Prox, Representative McKay, myself, Chair Rauscher, and I don't see any other legislators in the room at this time. I would like to thank our House Records Secretary, Jordan Wright, and our LIO moderator, Cindy Truitt, my committee aide, Craig Valdez, for all they do for this committee. It is work. I appreciate that. Before we begin, I'd like to remind the members of the committee and the people in the audience to silence your cell phones and any other electronics that you may have on your personage. We will have a slide presentation. If you would hold your questions till the end of each slide, I'd appreciate it, and direct all your questions through the chair and all your answers back through the chair. Today we will hear an overview of Launch Alaska, particularly about Houston Alaska Solar Farm and securing project financing from Clean Capital. We have with us on Teams Isaac Vandenberg, CEO of Launch Alaska, and John Powers, co-founder and CEO of Clean Capital. Mr. Vandenberg, I believe you will be presenting first, so you'll be presenting regarding Launch Alaska, followed by Mr. Powers to talk about Clean Capital. Mr. Vandenberg, if you would like to start, please place your name and affiliation on the record, and you may begin.
Okay, for the record, my name is Isaac Vandenberg, CEO of Launch Alaska, and just wanted to start by saying thank you, Chair Rauscher, for the invitation to speak today about Launch Alaska and the work that we do. We're also going to be talking today about our role in the state's largest solar farm today in Houston, Alaska. I'm also looking forward to working with you on the Governor's Energy Security Task Force. That's just getting started now. So, as I said, we're excited to share with you all a little bit about Launch Alaska today, and then specifically dive into a project that broke ground just this last year in Houston, Alaska, which is the state's largest solar project. Our view is that as the state is looking at increasing renewable energy deployment and increasing private capital investment in our state, we think that the project that we'll talk about today is a wonderful example and a success story of how this works well. We played a small role in this project, and I'm excited to also today to be joined by John Powers from Clean Capital, which is the investment firm that financed the Houston project. So if we can go to the next slide. A little bit about Launch Alaska as an organization. We were founded in, and I apologize, I have a head cold today, so sorry if I sound a little stuffy. We are a organization that was founded in 2016 in Anchorage, Alaska. We are a nonprofit organization, and our mission is to accelerate the energy transition and decarbonize the globe, starting in Alaska. We cultivate partnerships to connect climate tech companies and customers to catalyze Alaska's clean energy economy and build a regenerative future for us all. You can find out more about us at launchalaska.com. And just if we go to the next slide, briefly, our board of directors, you may recognize some of these folks. We have a great board that supports our work, representing, you know, lending institutions, STEM education in Alaska, climate tech startups, accounting, sustainable aviation, private equity, Alaska Native corporations, sovereign wealth fund management. It's a great and diverse board. All of them have very high level perspectives, powerful networks, and they also just bring kind of deep organizational management experience to our organization. And they have been wonderful mentors for me. And if we go to the next slide, we have a small but ever-growing team at Launch Alaska. Again, representing a diverse kind of set of backgrounds, but one thing you might find interesting is that a majority of our team has some background in working in oil and gas, which, you know, aligns right with our mission of accelerating this energy transition. We stand firmly rooted in the state's energy background, and our staff is representative of that. So if we go to the next slide. So Launch Alaska receives major funding support from the U.S. Navy Office of Naval Research, and as well as the U.S. Department of Energy Office of Tech Transitions. And we also get key organizational support from McKinley Alaska Private Investment. Basically, a third of our budget now comes from non-federal sources, non-government sources. We do all sorts of fee-for-service contract work as well, and that's an ever-growing portion of our budget. We're also supported by dozens of Alaska organizations, large and small, you know, almost too many to fit on the slide here, but again, representing Alaska Native corporations, resource development companies, utilities, research institutions, community groups, really runs the gamut. And I would just say that our work is entirely dependent on partnerships. We cannot do the work we do without essentially engaging dozens of other organizations who have an interest in the same future that we're trying to build together. And so it's very much these partnerships make everything work. And if we go to the next slide. So our goal at Launch Alaska is to facilitate the deployment of $1 billion worth of climate tech projects in Alaska by 2030. It's a very large undertaking that requires well-run programs, bold partnerships, groundbreaking projects. I can tell you that we set this goal in 2020, and it seemed incredibly ambitious at the time. We are making really good progress towards it. And we'll talk a little bit more about one of the projects specifically today, but there are more projects than I can fit into a single presentation. But just to put some numbers around this, you know, we're at currently $55.6 million of projects that have resulted from our work. And these are projects that have been, you know, funded and are actually being, you know, moving forward. There's another $100 million to our accounting of projects that are in the pipeline that are right on the verge of being having, you know, project commitments executed and getting the financing in place. So, you know, we use $55 million as the conservative number, but I can just tell you that this is a kind of algorithmic growth. This is not we're feeling, I guess to put it another way, we're feeling very comfortable that this number is achievable by 2030. But, you know, these projects take a while to get started. You may hear some of that today from John Powers, the next speaker. They can take a year or two or even three to get, you know, before ground is breaking on these projects. And so, you know, it makes sense that we have a slower start, but it ramps up over time. And if we go to the next slide, but we need to move quickly here. If there's any questions, please.
Mr. Vandenberg, Representative Wright has a question.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair. Mr. Vandenberg, could you go into detail how you expect to meet your goal of $1 billion by 2030, or is it in another slide coming up here soon?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you, I might actually answer that at the end of the presentation once you have a feel for the kinds of kind of projects that we're in the middle of.
Okay.
But I can tell you that this is a combination of projects that our portfolio companies, which I'll explain in a moment, are engaged in, and then projects that our innovation team is getting essentially unstuck. And I can tell you there's more demand, there's more opportunity than we have capacity right now to respond to, and but I'll dive into that a little bit more through the chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Wright.
Thank you.
Follow up. You're right. All right, continue, please, Mr. Vandenberg.
Okay, next slide. So the kind of bread and butter of our organization, or the first program that we created, is what's called the Tech Deployment Track Program. And this is a 8-month deployment accelerator where we recruit and work with mid to late stage companies that have technologies in energy, transportation, and industry. And specifically companies who are looking to representative rights question to identify projects or community partners or infrastructure partners that they can work with. And so it's essentially, you know, 8 months of helping companies build connections with some of the, you know, potential customers and project people that can make decisions on projects in Alaska. You know, ports, utilities, municipalities, airports tend to be some of those counterparts. And this program started in 2019, and we run one program a year, essentially, and we're currently recruiting companies for our next cohort. And on the next slide, I can give you a little bit of a feeling for what kinds of companies we're talking about here. So the, as I mentioned, the Tech Deployment Track focuses on companies with groundbreaking technologies in three major areas, energy, transportation, and industry. And this slide gives you a feel for some of those technology areas that we recruit in. And the reason that we have identified these technology areas is because we are interviewing some of those same folks that I mentioned earlier, utilities, ports, airports, infrastructure owners of all stripes, and asking them what their needs are. And then on an annual basis, we're going out and scanning, really scanning the globe for technologies and companies that that can meet some of those needs. And so when these companies go through our 8-month program, if they are successful and they sign some kind of joint development agreement or a letter of intent or have a contract, then that is our metric of success. There's actually a project that they've conceived of with an Alaska partner. And at that point, those companies then work their way into our portfolio. And so on the next slide, if you look at the current portfolio companies, this is those folks. So these are young companies with groundbreaking technologies that have found some kind of a project in Alaska. And the current number of companies in our portfolio is 24. We will be very soon adding 8 more companies to our portfolio. And we do this every spring, and the number keeps growing. And, you know, if you follow us on our newsletter or follow us on social media, you'll get real-time updates when we release the new companies that have come into our portfolio. But to give you a feel, on the energy side, the companies there represent kind of in order from top left to bottom right. These companies have microgrid controls, energy storage, mobile nanogrids, decarbonization as a service software, a wave energy company, a company that does data centers, 2 micronuclear companies, wind energy, a company that has essentially an alternative to storage, a company called Switch Source, and then a natural gas compression company. Within the transportation area, the companies, again, going that same order, electric aviation, EV charging, heavy-duty drones, logistics software, and fuel-saving software. And then last but not least, if you go into the industry vertical, the companies have technologies around high organic wastewater treatment, PFAS remediation, which is becoming a huge deal nationally and in Alaska in particular, waste-to-energy, smart boys, and also a company that creates digital twins. That last one there is a really interesting company called Cartorium, that's an Alaska firm. and is seeing just incredible growth right now. They're one of the companies we're most proud of, and we always love to have technology companies that are born in Alaska, that are homegrown.
Mr. Vandenberg, can I ask you something? Most of the companies that you have here, I assume, are doing projects for private industry, but I was wondering, do you do work for government? Do you try to find funding for government projects?
Yeah, so there is some of that. You know, a project that we're doing in Kotzebue currently, which involves Cartorium as well as Dynamics and 60 Hertz is involved in that project as well. You know, part of the funding for that project came from the Denali Commission as well as State of Alaska, and then the utility itself, and then there's a mix of other sources of funding for that project. So in that sense, yeah, I mean, some of the projects, another one that I've spoken about briefly in other hearings is a project with the Port of Alaska, where essentially the port is trying to build a microgrid and improve the kind of resilience of the port, you know, the port energy system. And so, you know, we helped get a proposal together to secure a large award for a what's essentially a big battery at the Port of Alaska. And so there's definitely a role for some of these companies to be going after, you know, some of the bill or IRA funding and working with government customers, essentially.
All right, thank you very much. Please continue.
Thank you for the question, and I'll go to the next slide here. So just to see, you know, if you'd have asked me 3 years ago, a lot of these numbers would have been zero or frighteningly close to zero. but these numbers are growing really quickly. And so it's the trajectory that I care about more than the raw numbers. But just to kind of give an overview, you know, we have 24 active companies in our portfolio. In 2022, we saw 6 projects deployed in 8 Alaska communities. Those generated $320,000 in revenue for the companies. We also had 27 project commitments secured in Alaska in 2022. So you can see the difference between projects that got deployed this year, and then the pipeline is ever growing in terms of project commitments that are coming together for 2023 and 2024. And then $3.8 million in project revenue from those project commitments that were secured in 2022. And then we also track for all of our companies the amount of CO2 emissions reduction. That's one of our main goals, is reducing CO2 emissions. And you can see this number of 80,000 megatons of CO2 were reduced through our companies in 2022. And we expect that number just to be growing extremely quickly as well. Okay, and if we can go to the next slide. So,
you have a question, Representative?
Excuse me,
Mr. Vandenberg. I have a question from from Representative McKay.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Vandenberg. I was just curious, you know, the 80,000 metric tons of CO2, was that all in Alaska? And where did it go? If we removed it, where did it go?
Yes. So,
sorry. We just did the carbon storage bill and the House resources, so I was just trying to kind of connect the dots, right?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative McKay, thank you for the question. So those are emissions that were reduced essentially by, putting on technologies such as solar and storage and other technologies. We avoided or reduced emissions in those communities. Okay. So we are not currently doing any sort of carbon removal or direct air capture among our portfolio companies. It's an interesting area that I think we'll see a lot more activity in Alaska in the future for reasons you all are very aware of. But this is just projects that got built that avoided or kind of reduced the emissions profile of these communities.
Okay, I got it. Thank you.
Representative Brock has a question.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I'm 80,000 million tons. Is that possible? Metric tons. Okay, very good. 80,000 metric tons of CO2. As compared to what? I guess that... how many... I guess we'd equate that to gallons of diesel fuel or something like that that would have produced that much CO2. Is there something to compare to put that number in context?
So through the chair, excellent question. I can, as a follow-up, I'm wary of doing math in real time. I whenever I'm in front of a camera, I get 30% less intelligent with math. And so if you don't mind, Representative, I can send you a follow-up that puts that number in perspective. What I can say, just to give some context, is that you know, that number, the metric tons of CO2, is a number that in any sort of plans around emissions reduction, whether it's the North Slope or within industry, that those number that's kind of the metric that everyone uses is those CO2 lifetime metric tons CO2 lifetime. I think in Alaska the current number total is 80 metric tons. And so this is kind of compared to business as usual, those numbers. But I can follow up to kind of give you a little bit of context to show the apples to apples comparison.
Representative,
follow up. Yes, it would be interesting to get a feel for that. How many metric tons are we trying to reduce to get a feel for what that really means? I guess it would be either in terms of total fuel usage to produce some sort of energy versus how much CO2 that produces versus what we're doing now, and are we getting somewhere, you know, somewhere to some overall goal?
Right. And I can follow up with this. I mean, unfortunately, we don't really have great numbers for Alaska yet. Just as a state, no one has good numbers for our total metric tons of CO2 emissions. But I can give you numbers to put this in some context. I can tell you that this is a very small portion of the total emissions. We are just getting started with these projects that reduce emissions for the state. But again, through the chair, Representative Wright, I can follow up with that information if that's okay with you.
Okay, thank you.
And we appreciate that. And Representative Wright has a question he'd like to ask.
Thank you, Chair Rosher. Through the chair, you spoke of PFAS, Mr. Vandenberg, and I was just wondering what company that is that you are working with. And also, what have they done in Alaska so far in regards to PFAS?
Yes, so Representative Wright, through the chair, the two companies that have technology for PFAS remediation are Aquaga and Ecospheres. And so Aquaga is an interesting company. Again, most of our portfolio companies come from outside the state, but Aquaga does have roots within the state. Based out of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and then also some IP, some intellectual property from the University of Alaska University of Washington. And so some of their business development is not public knowledge yet, but I can tell you that they did receive a award to explore a demonstration of their technology at JBear here in Anchorage. They received some funding through the EPA to essentially do an early demonstration project. I can also say that EcoSpheres is based out of the Lower 48, and they have been communicating with the folks at Ted Stevens International Airport to see if they can help with some of the PFAS issues that are that Ted Stevens is working through. So those are two really meaningful projects for those companies. And in some ways, the challenges that we have is that there's so much demand for PFAS remediation technology right now, nationally and really globally, that part of our challenge is finding projects that are meaningful, so these companies, see Alaska as a really meaningful market for them to kind of grow their operations.
Well, thank you. Follow-up, Representative? Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Vandenberg.
Okay. So, if we can go to the next slide. So basically everything that I've been chatting about or presenting on so far is in relationship to that tech deployment track program that I mentioned to you earlier. And that's the 8-month program that we run companies through. In early 2020, we recognized as an organization that while there is some really exciting opportunities in Alaska for these high growth startups and high growth companies, that there weren't as many projects being pushed forward, and there had been a lot of kind of assessments and feasibility studies and research done on pieces of Alaska, but actually projects that were being funded and, had RFPs or opportunities for companies to bid on, those were few and far between. And a lot of them had just kind of been stuck oftentimes for a decade or longer. And so in early 2020, we added this kind of second part of our organization, which is the kind of deployment and innovation team at Launch Alaska. And what this group does is they work with some of those same folks that we've been talking about that are so important, those infrastructure owners in the state, and essentially work with them to get some of those projects unstuck, to get them off of high center, as we say. And so you can see a lot of these. There's a few articles on some of these projects here that we've put in the slide. There was a what was an award-winning project in Chignac with the community microgrid there that two of our companies worked with an Alaska developer to build essentially a storage and solar system that allowed the community of Chignac to, for the first time, turn off its diesels for a little while in the middle of the summer, which is a start. That's actually quite a milestone for that community. Another project is this one in Kotzebue Electric, where we're helping the utility think about a roadmap to 100% renewable energy. Another project that this team has catalyzed is this Port of Alaska power plant and microgrid project that I mentioned briefly earlier. As well as with the municipality of Anchorage, the solid waste services, a fleet electrification project. One of our companies, eCamion, is working on that project. And so just giving you a feel that this other side of the organization, where we're working with companies and developers and also infrastructure owners to just get projects going. Things, plans that have been sitting on the shelf for decades, getting those off the shelf and then just pushing finding what's holding them up and just kind of pushing them forward. And so that has been a really exciting part of our organization. I can tell you over the last 3 years, all of the growth in our team and in our organization has been on this side of the house with the deployment and innovation team. And we're just seeing a lot of, this is a very common thing last year, where there's projects that are good ideas, but just never never had that that kind of catalyzing push to get them actually moving forward. And so if we go to the next slide, the one project that is we wanted to talk about a little bit today, and we'll segue into our next speaker here, is the Houston Solar Farm that just broke ground this last year in Houston, Alaska. This project is being developed by Renewable IPP and is an 8.5 megawatt solar array. You know, while that might sound small, it's the largest solar project to date in Alaska, and is, I think, just, which I think John will talk about, just the tip of the iceberg here. There's a lot more coming in the pipeline from solar, and the project provides power to MEA. You know, enough power for 1,400 homes in the borough. What I think is really kind of precedent setting about this project is that in order for the company to secure a power purchase agreement and get it approved by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, that they had to show that this was more affordable than the current source of the current contracts that the MEA had with natural gas. And so, you know, just doing that on a project this small, and also there was a few things going on globally that made the prices kind of eke in the wrong direction. And the fact that this project still got through and was competitive, even before some of the recent Hillcorp announcements or some of the, you know, recent increases in prices that we've had, is really remarkable. And it's very precedent setting because it shows that as projects get bigger and as you deploy more and more solar, this just becomes better and better. In some ways, solar is least economic when it's smaller and gets more economic as it gets larger over time. And this project was great. Created 30 to 40 local construction jobs and 15 to 20 part-time maintenance jobs. Our work on this was very small. It was, you know, really that catalytic role that we play in so many projects, which is essentially helping the team at Renewable IPP find a tax equity and debt investor and secure the financing. And so, literally, my role was being on the phone with a bunch of companies that were interested in this kind of a project and down selecting from that initial group to a few finalists, and then Queen Power was the company that, for a variety of reasons, ended up getting the financing this project. And John, who will speak next, will talk about that project. But again, just a great project and emblematic of so much that we're excited about in the state. I also mentioned before going to the next slide that
Mr. Vandenberg, Representative Carrick has a question.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Vandenberg, through the chair. I'm curious just about Launch Alaska's role after groundbreaking. So I know that you've mentioned catalyzing projects, and is the role of Launch Alaska mostly on the financing side and finding partnerships? And in the example of the Houston Solar Farm, is there a continuing role that Launch Alaska plays in the management of that project?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Carrick, for the great question. Really, our role with this project is done at this point. So much of what we do is get projects moving and then quickly turn it over to the private sector to take over. And that this project is a great example of that. We helped get it up and running, get the financing in place, get a relationship with Real IPP, and then they've just done an amazing job getting this project actually over the finish line. What I can say is that finding financing for projects is one thing that we do. We also do some kind of pre-design and pre-engineering work. We have some folks on the team who are skilled with what's called, home remodeling or techno-economic analysis. We do some of that. We also help, as an example, the project in Kotzebue. We're essentially working with Cartorium, a digital twin of the community energy infrastructure, so that private investors and private industry and folks who would want to help do a project in Kotzebue can actually, see all of the infrastructure and how it all interacts. But then that project at some point will get it ready, and then the private sector will be the one that finances it, and there will be private developers and engineering firms and other folks that take over. So we're really in that kind of pre-development, pre-engineering phase, getting these projects to the point where the private sector can take over.
Representative Kerrick, a follow-up? Representative McKay has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Vandenberg, very quickly, I was just trying to keep up with all the acronyms. I was trying to figure out IPP. Can you tell me what IPP stands for? I don't want to guess,
Yes. Through the chair, Representative McKay. IPP is an independent power producer, as opposed to what we've largely done in Alaska in the past is the utilities, do all of their own generation of power. And again, what's precedent setting about this project in Houston is that it was an independent power producer, a private developer that develops the solar farm. And
So are they like a publicly traded corporation, or what are they, an LLC, S-Corp, or kind of?
So they're a private company. They're just a fantastic group.
Sure they are.
They are former oil and gas engineers who started a local small business. Jen Miller is the CEO, right. And a small team, not a publicly traded corporation yet, a small. I don't know what their entity type is. John may know, our next speaker.
That's okay. It's a great
small business in Alaska.
Trying to kind of get more educated on what all these little companies do. Now, my second question, I'd like to go back to PFAS, because obviously remediation of PFAS is a really complicated, difficult, challenging problem. So you mentioned that there was two companies that did PFAS remediation, AquaGa and EcoSpheres. I hope I pronounced those correctly. And I was just trying to connect with what does PFAS remediation have to do with accelerating the energy transition and decarbonizing the globe? Because I don't really see where that, it's probably great work they do, but it didn't seem to connect with your mission statement. I guess maybe you could explain that a little better.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative McKay. And just a clarifying point before taking that question, with the Houston Solar Farm, I want to be totally clear that all of the pre-development and design work was done by Renewal IPP. That was not a project where we did any of that. Our role in that project was just securing the financing. So just thinking through my comments, I want to make it clear that the wonderful folks at Renewal IPP did all the design and development work on that project. And so to your question, Representative McKay, through the chair, the reason we were excited about these two companies, AquaGa and EcoSpheres in particular, from a climate and carbon perspective, is that the current approach to PFAS remediation is essentially taking huge amounts of soil and shipping it to a facility somewhere that then is essentially incinerated, taken to such high temperatures that this very tough molecule within PFAS breaks apart, and then taking that soil and shipping it and or trucking it back to the site and putting it back in the hole. And You can imagine the amount of energy that that takes to do is really remarkable. And so both of these companies essentially have in situ and also highly energy efficient ways to break down PFAS, and it's a game changer in terms of the emissions profile of that entire industry. So that was the link for us that made it seem like a good technology.
That's really great. I'm glad I asked, because I was having a hard time seeing that and incineration like they do with PCBs and other materials. So thank you for that explanation. It's now much more clear. Thank you.
Okay. That's a great question.
Representative, Mr. Vandenberg, please continue.
Okay, and if we can go to my final slide here, I just wanted to have a little, again, sing the praises of the Renewable IPP team. They put it in a really tight quote here, which Launch Alaska was instrumental in connecting our Alaska-grown businesses with investors and enabling us to go from a startup to a real contributor to the Alaska economy. And that was from Jen Miller, the CEO of Renewable IPP. And you can see at the groundbreaking, Governor Dunleavy and some of the local representative and senators were at the groundbreaking, as well as the MEA team. And it was a great day, and a day that we hope to see repeated many times again in the future. And so that concludes my comments, and I'm anxious to hand it over to our next speaker here, who will be able to dive in more deeply into that specific project to give you a feel for how these things actually work. But are there any other questions for me?
No, I don't see any at this time. I appreciate your presentation. It was very enlightening. Thank you very much. I know that it's going to be a big project for the Houston area out there. And we're looking forward to seeing what it looks like when it's completed and understanding how that's going to matriculate to the ratepayers, if it does at all. But anyway, appreciate your presentation. And I guess now we will move on to Mr. John Powers. If you would put your name and your affiliation on record, and you can begin your presentation. You might want to unmute.
That's helpful. Thank you. a couple years of doing this, I should have that down by now.
I do it myself.
John Powers. Yeah, yes, sir. well, thank you, Chairman, for the opportunity. My name is John Powers. I'm the president and co-founder of Clean Capital. And just listening to the conversation, I'll get into some of the questions you guys actually raised to Isaac, which I think I hopefully I'll be able to answer. But before doing that, 20 years ago, I was deployed to Iraq as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom, 20 years next month. And I was a young Army officer, spent 15 months in Baghdad and later in a city called Najaf, and then she went back the following summer as well. And it was through that experience that I first got interested in the idea of energy. We lived in Uday Hussein's palace in the Tigris River. It was in the heart of one of the most volatile sectors of Baghdad in that time frame. And every night we had a group of Iraqis who worked in the base with us who would leave at around 6 o'clock. We always knew they left with intelligence, and by 6:40 or 6:50, we'd be receiving mortar rounds to wherever our fuel trucks had been parked that day. So we knew as soon as they left, we'd have to move our fuel trucks. And that was my first inkling of the idea of energy security. And as I began to look at it more and study it more and step back and look at it more from a geopolitical level, I really began to understand the challenges to our energy posture and the opportunities to both diversify our energy mix and really bring energy security to the forefront. And I've been down to work on those issues in Washington for about 15 years, both at the Pentagon and the White House, before co-founding Clean Capital. So I've actually known Isaac since he started Launch Alaska, and actually hearing an update from him on this was really, really fantastic for me, because it's the work that he's doing, and we see it in a lot of other places that we work nationwide, is really critical to creating an ecosystem of entrepreneurs who can help bring both outside capital and opportunity for jobs locally into a place like Alaska. If you go to the next slide. So I just want to talk to you for a second about what we do at Clean Capital, and then I'm going to get into sort of the broader market trends and then talk a little bit about our, obviously, our work with the Houston Project at RIP. So folks have questions about IPPs, for instance. There's obviously a clear transition happening, clean energy transition happening, both nationwide as well as globally. We're moving from a purely centralized grid to a more of a decentralized grid, and you have a lot of new players coming in who are both developing and owning opportunities like solar assets. Clean Capital, we started in 2015. We started to acquire actually only operating assets since we launched, but since then have really got into development. We've deployed over $1 billion into solar and storage projects in 26 states, including Alaska now, but Hawaii, Guam, and we'll get to later some of the map to where we're deploying across the U.S. Overall. We are based, I'm actually based here in Buffalo, New York, but a lot of our team is based in New York, but sort of spread out across the U.S. And part of the RIP transaction, the Renewable Energy IPP transaction with Jen and others, which I'll talk about more, is we began to really work closely with local developers to both create opportunities for projects, but also to provide them the rocket fuel that they need to grow and expand. So if you go to the next slide. I want to spend a second sort of talking about where we are in terms of the broader clean energy market. You know, solar panels, for instance, aren't a new technology. They were developed in the 70s by NASA. And, you know, really were pretty much an alternative energy at the best up until around 2010. There was a whole series of policy things that happened between 2009 and, say, 2020 that helped really bring efficiency into the clean energy space. And that has done a variety of things, including drive down the cost of the technology itself. And you can see that in the yellow line represented on the graph. And as that cost of the technology has significantly declined, deployment has really skyrocketed. And that is not just that you can do this very similar graph, not just for the actual cost of the panel, but, you know, the number of folks that are trained to install these, for instance, or how the financing has looked at these. But really, the growth of the clean energy market over the last decade has been pretty monumental. And we are at a very clear transitional point. Clean energy, the development of the clean energy economy, that growth will continue to scale, and more capital is moving into this space. If you go to the next slide.
Before we do, Representative Prox has a question.
Yes, thank you. We can see on your graph for the last 10, 15 years, the price of solar panels, I guess if we've called, is going down. People are getting better at manufacturing them, but I've heard some concerns that we're reaching the supply limit of the raw material that goes into the panels and the infrastructure that supports them, be that steel or aluminum or whatever. But moving forward, will the lack of the basic commodities and minerals affect the price of these solar panels and installation?
Yeah. It's
what are you projecting for that?
Through the chair, thank you so much for that question, sir. I'd say that two things. One, there are supply issues in all industries right now. When you talk about steel and aluminum, it's not just solar that's being hit by those by any means. But some of the raw materials that go into panels, it's more of a challenge actually for energy storage than it is like batteries than it is for panels themselves. I think people estimate panels will remain in the region they are now in terms of pricing, maybe continue to get a little more cost effective. We're seeing significant manufacturing facilities being built in the domestic U.S. now. If you follow closely, for instance, the state of Georgia, the governor of Georgia has had major announcements in the last 18 months with partners like Qcell Energy, where they are really bringing manufacturing back from overseas to be done here at home. We expect significant efficiency to be driven through that as well, and I think taking some of the supply risk away. But we don't expect a pop in terms of the cost. There was some cost through COVID that solar panels went up, but I think we're expecting to remain sort of in the same ballpark and maybe even getting continued cheaper over time. And it's important to note, it's not about the panels always that's cost, right? So there is the raw materials. The panels are getting better and more efficient. What does that mean? So if you had the same, you know, 3-foot by 6-foot panel 10 years ago, it might produce a kill, and these are totally fake numbers, but it might produce, you know, 25 kilowatts. And today it might produce 40 or 50 for the same size panel. So we're getting much better at it, much more efficient. They're creating things like bifacial panels where it's not just receiving the sun from the top, but also the reflection in a place like Alaska where there's a lot of snow, or a place like Buffalo where there's a lot of snow, the reflection of the sun from the backside as well. Or you're doing white rooftops where you're getting that. And it just increases the efficiency. So we're getting better and better at the technology. And at this point, you know, the solution isn't about a new technology. It's about sort of growth and deployment. 60% of the cost to these projects, almost 70% are what are known as soft costs. So it's like financing, it's permitting, it's all those different pieces. The technology continues to be less and less of a piece to it. And, you know, from Capital's perspective, we go after the soft costs and try to bring it, address those challenges as well. I hope that answers your question.
Representative, follow up?
Not quite. Follow up?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't talked, I don't have numbers on what panel expectations, there are some numbers in here on what panel expectations are, but I think you're asking a supply chain question.
Well,
that will affect our industry, but I think honestly all industries, when you talk about aluminum, steel, other supplies as well, we've seen a leveling off of that in the last 6 months. But during COVID, there was a huge spike in supply challenges for sure.
Right. But the concern was the global global shortage in raw materials, minerals, and et cetera. We've got X amount of minerals being produced today, and it can only supply Y amount of solar panel or everything else production. And, you know, if you run short, if the demand for oil exceeds the price of, or the supply of oil, oil goes up. If the demand for any other mineral exceeds the supply, the price goes up quite rapidly. And there seems to be a looming shortage of these basic minerals. And how is that going to affect the price of these panels and et cetera?
Yeah, through the chair, so to better understand what you're asking, so there are some challenges around things like rare earths, right, that go into panels, but go into a lot of other technologies as well. And I think there's, so one of the things that are going on is here, and I'm by no means a rare earth expert, so I just want to clarify this, but there is a growth in manufacturing or mining of that in places like Texas to get more access to those. But one of the things the solar industry is doing, for instance, is really introducing ways to actually to break down old panels and pull out the rare earths and other minerals out of those to use in the new panels going forward. But from basic economics, I think if there was a pinch on the supply of what's going into the PV, for instance, yeah, you're going to see some pop in demand, in costs. But the reality is they've come down so dramatically over the last 10 years that even, you know, some pop, it's not the major cost of the project.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, please continue. Thank you very much.
Yeah, if you go to the next slide, I just want to give it sort of a broader market update to what's driving the clean energy growth at home. I think I talked about the cost of the panels themselves, and those are some of the reasons that you're seeing more deployment. But you're also seeing monumental investment in this space, as well as a tremendous growth in demand. So large corporations continue to drive clean energy demand in the U.S. Last year alone, they signed over almost 20 gigawatts of renewable energy in 2022. That's driven by companies like Walmart and Home Depot, by Apple, by Microsoft, who are buying clean energy from assets, and I'll talk more about that a little bit later, in contractual ways that they can look at what their energy budget is going to look like, not just today, but going out to the future. And the importance of that, when you think about the fossil fuel industry today and some of the costs that have caused challenges, is when you have a spike in natural gas, when President Putin invades Ukraine and natural gas prices go through the roof, that's caused a lot of folks to have much higher utility bills, right? Companies like these that I've listed, as well as the Pentagon, are doing contractual arrangements now for renewables because they know what the budget will look like to pay for those renewables for many times 20 years. We do 20-year contracts in some cases. And they can budget that in and understand the costs to their social impacts, environmental impacts for sure. But so much of this is being driven by the CFOs off. And as a result, you have significant commitments by global corporate leaders to do things like 100% renewable energy goals. And many are on track to do that by, some are doing it literally today and some by the end of the decade. And then private investment in the space and the energy transition has continued to skyrocket. We shattered records in 2022. Over $1 trillion globally was invested into the clean energy transition. In the U.S., we had over $141 billion invested in the space. That's significant growth over the year before and continues to grow year after year. And the investors are looking at this, not purely looking at this from a double bottom line perspective, they're looking at these as assets that they can invest in that have solid returns like real estate, agriculture, forestry, you know, you have big pension funds, you have life insurance companies and others making major commitments into clean energy because it's a new and proven now asset class. It's come a long way in the last 10 years. And as a result, more and more capital is moving into this space and helping to drive the deployment of projects.
Mr. Powers, I was wondering, when you look at the minerals needed to build a lot of these projects, whether they're solar panels or whatever, I was wondering, is there a lot of investment in mining because of that all over the world, or is it just certain areas, or what type of investment do you see, or do we, or can we expect in mining to be able to accommodate some of these projects?
Yeah, through the chair, again, I'm not a mining expert, but to hit on some of the key things that have driven the last year on this as driving investment. We don't invest in mining per se, right? Clean capital, but at a federal level, there were a couple of key things that has dollars going into mining for things like rare earth. One of them, you know, the two big pieces of legislation passed in Washington last year with the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the Inflation Reduction Act. Both of those have groundbreaking dollars being poured into things like mining, as well as manufacturing here at home. And then the Pentagon actually put in place, they're going to announce it, the Defense Production Act to focus on finding ways to increase mining here in the U.S. So there has been a significant amount of focus there. And what you've seen now in the private sector is a lot of companies popping up that are doing this. I point to Texas because Texas is really leading the way. It's an opportunity, I think, for places like Alaska and others as well. Depends on where the minerals are for this. But there is definitely growth in domestic mining for these assets.
Well, thank you very much. Mr. Powers, please continue.
Go to the next slide. So I just want to show a forecast to give you a sense of how the industry has grown. So I'm focusing solely on solar here, not storage or wind or other or hydro or other clean energy technologies that are on the grid today. But you can see from what we've talked about, that the last decade was really when the hockey stick began. And over the next 10 years, I think year after year have record monumental growth in this market because the efficiencies come to the market, the capitals come to the market, the people understand what these projects look like and how they operate, how they're contracted. The policy at certain levels has aligned that really are continuing to bring costs. And as a result, things like solar in most of the U.S. is the most cost-effective kilowatt that you can bring to the grid because of the alignment of the ways the policies have worked. If you fall back to like 2010 and look at the beginning of this, you can see where, as the industry's grown, the alignment has been really key. There's, you see bumps in the growth, and that is because of certain things like tax credits expiry, et cetera. But the overall trend continues to remain solid. Post the passage of the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the Inflation Reduction Act, the next phase of this through 2030, you'll continue to see growth. And this breaks down things like utility scale solar, which means usually large projects that are pumping power to the grid. Things like community solar, which I'll talk about more in a second. Commercial project, which is sort of where we focus. We focus in the middle ground. We don't do massive large-scale projects at very often. And then residential growth as well. Community solar is a unique program that's developed in a handful of states where it allows a homeowner, like I'm a community solar customer here in Buffalo. I can't put solar panels on my roof. So I buy into a system that's, you know, 50 miles down the road in Batavia. But there's very clear and certain policies that have to be in place to incentivize that. And as a result, I actually save significant money on my utility bill. The next slide. And I think the piece that doesn't get talked about enough here is, folks understanding how the financing works on these projects. So I want to spend a little bit of time on this. And then I want to get just a, I think we'll talk a little bit about jobs too. The opportunity for localized jobs continues to grow and scale. And we'll talk about some of those numbers here in a second. But, and please stop me if this is too simplified, but I wanted just to really give an example of the contractual arrangements that and how they work. So when we build a solar farm, solar plant, solar array, whatever you call it, whether it be in the rooftop of a facility or something down the road from a facility, that is only part of the equation. You know, much like commercial real estate, when you build a commercial real estate building, you know, you usually build the building and then you find the tenants. And clean energy is a little bit different. To build the system, you need to know who's going to buy the power. In Alaska, for instance, our, you know, current deal, which we'll talk about more, the person that buys that power is the utility, right? But that's not always the case. We have, for instance, huge landfill projects where we're selling them to major tech companies who are buying the power off of those contracts. So we can then contract out that power for 20 years. 20 years was this sort of a standard set about 5 or 10 years ago. It's getting a little bit shorter these days. But for the most part, you have a long-term contract for the buyer power. And then we can use that contract and that structure to finance the deal. So, you know, we know who's going to buy the power. Then we can finance the construction of the plant. And then, you know, we usually stay on and own and operate. You know, we are long-term owners. At Clean Capital, we get our funding, our investments through life insurance. So a firm called Manulife, where, you know, they're basically taking your life insurance money and they want to park it in a safe asset that they know when they need that money in 20 years, it's there. And they don't want to risk it. So, you know, we're taking that long-term capital and investing it. And there's different types of capital in these projects. I'm happy to talk to you more of that too, but you have basically classic equity. You have what's known as tax equity, which comes off the tax credits that are in the space. You have debt on these projects as well.
Representative Carrick has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. On the community solar piece, I'm curious if Clean Capital has any involvement or investment in Fairbanks' Golden Valley Electric Association project to establish community solar. It's a project in the interior with our local utility company that's just getting off the ground. So just curious, are there any community solar projects, including that one in Alaska, that Clean Capital is working on currently?
Uh, through the chair, Representative Kerr, it's a great question. I'm not familiar with Devon, but we would be interested in learning more about it. We are invested in community solar projects in a handful of states, mostly places like New York, Minnesota. It's really pretty popular coming in places like we'll be soon on board in Michigan and New Mexico. The key to community solar is sort of how the policies align. And it's something I'm happy to sort of share more of what we've learned in other states and what works really well, so that we can look to invest. So we'd be very open and interested to learn more about that, for sure.
Just a
follow-up. I think, one of the notes that as you talk about community solar, one of the most important things for us as an investor, and I'll talk about this a little later in another slide, is policy certainty, right? The more we understand what the policy landscape looks like for investing, the better capital you're going to attract to Alaska, right? If you know community solar programs are in place and they're functioning well, you can get a better cost of capital, and which really means a cheaper power for your residents or business.
Follow-up question, Representative Kerr?
Yes, thank you for that. And on the homeowner solar installation front, I see that is also an increasing – the residential market is also increasing. And what role does an organization like Clean Capital play in helping residential folks transition to solar or other renewable energy sources?
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Representative Kerr. So we actually don't work in residential. There are a lot of companies like ours that do. We focus mostly in what I refer to as the middle market, which is working with companies in sort of smaller utility projects, unless we're doing community solar, where we are investing in a – so community solar project is usually a larger project that many residential members are buying into. It's almost like a pool project. When you're talking about personal rooftops, that's just – it's almost – that is a very exciting space. And very much almost like a commodity space these days where it's almost like getting a car loan to do it. It's just something we don't actually do ourselves.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Powers, please continue.
Yeah. I'm happy to come back to talk more about how these things are financed if you need them. But if you go to the next slide, I think one of the things that does not get talked about enough is the job creation that's happening in clean energy today. If you go to the next slide, 40% of the jobs in the energy sector today are solar jobs. Solar has more jobs than coal, oil, or natural gas combined, and it continues to grow year after year. The importance about these, as well as things like wind jobs, is these are localized jobs, right? These are folks that are installing on rooftops. They're electricians. They are folks that are coming to take care of the, we have to mow the lawn under the solar facilities pretty regularly, for instance, right? So there's a variety of jobs that are aligned in solar that are here to stay and can stay locally. What we've seen over the last couple of years as this market grows, solar, for instance, pre-pandemic and then actually through the pandemic was the fastest job growth space in the country, and you have folks moving from other industries that are interested in the opportunity of a good paying job. The solar park in many cases does play a role. As a vet, there's a tremendous amount of veterans that have moved in this space because they understand the impacts of the work they're doing. But is the job opportunity cannot be underplayed here. It's really important, and it's happening all over the U.S. Next slide.
Just a second, Mr. Powers. I was just wondering, I'm looking at your slide. Yeah. There's thousands, right? Every one of those numbers is in thousands. Is that correct?
Thousands, yeah.
Is that nationwide? Or is that, 345,000 jobs in solar? I'm wondering, is that nationwide?
That's nationwide, yes. This comes from Department of Energy. So every year there is every year there's a phenomenal book that gets put out by a group called Bloomberg New Energy Finance, as well as the Business Council for Sustainable Energy, which collects a lot of this data from places like DOE and others. It compiles it, and happy to share some of that forward for you all so you can see where the jobs are, you know, where those numbers are coming from. But these numbers particularly come from DOE, and yes, this is nationwide. And they can break it down by state, by the way.
I was just wondering.
It's really great.
I guess everybody's always worried about family paying jobs, whether the amount of money that they're going to make on a job is sufficient to raise their family. So these jobs here, what are we talking about, say, per hour or per year? Do you have any inkling for us on those type of numbers?
Through the chair, so I wouldn't want to put a hard number on it because it depends on the job, right? So you have an electrician who is so, for instance, when we talk about the opportunity that we've developed with renewable IPP folks in Alaska, that project created 30 to 40 construction jobs, or will be as the construction's underway, and 15 to 20 sort of maintenance jobs, right? So that is jobs being built or used during the construction. So those are any type of construction roles. You've got to do everything from pounding the steel that actually holds the panels up into the ground, to wiring it, to managing the Wi-Fi for the system, which provides us the intelligence of what's producing, as well as sort of standard maintenance jobs. And the maintenance is not like a plant that is getting constantly maintained, but they are pretty regular maintenance roles. So I would in the current bills that pass through Congress have a lot of incentives to push out higher paying jobs in this space. And I'm happy to go more into that, but it's something that, is continue to be incentivized, through these projects.
Yeah, I get it. It varies depending on what part of the industry you're actually working in. So, Representative Carrick has a question.
Yeah, thank you through the chair. It would be interesting to see this graph over a longer time horizon. So you have the 2018 and 2019 numbers here, and it doesn't necessarily demonstrate a huge growth in the sector. Can you maybe elaborate on how that massive number of solar jobs has increased exponentially, perhaps, over a longer time horizon of, say, the last decade? In other words, is this huge number of additional jobs in the solar industry a more recent transition?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, that's a great question. And actually, I have a podcast that focuses specifically on this space. And I just interviewed the people, folks that did this report. And we did a look back over the last 10 years of some of this data. And without having the numbers at my fingertips, the graph you saw on growth in the industry, the hockey stick graph, can be very much tied to the same thing with jobs. And I can share with you through Launch Alaska the actual fact book and the data behind it. They actually take a look at the last 10 years and the growth. So that same curve that was known as sort of the hockey stick curve is seen in jobs, and actually it handled COVID fairly well, right? You didn't see a massive drop off in COVID. You did see some drop off as you did in a lot of industries, but the trends are very clear in terms of growth. People like the Marines are doing training for Marines that are getting out to actually move into the energy industry because so many are interested. So they're learning about installing on residential rooftops. They're learning about opportunities to be electricians on these projects and getting their certification so they can roll right into the job market, which is a very hot job market for this space. And there's organizations like Grid Alternatives, which I'm not sure if they work in Alaska, but work in a lot of both rural and urban communities where they are training individuals through installations on their own rooftops and then getting them the certification to get jobs in those markets. And they are seeing tremendous traction in those individuals finding jobs pretty immediately in this space.
Follow up, Representative? All right, Mr. Powers, please. Representative Brooks has a question.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, it appears that this chart or this graph is just showing raw job numbers per energy source. Is that correct? Like there's 80,000, 85,000 or something like that working in energy produced through coal and 340,000, 350,000 through energy produced with solar. Is that just raw jobs?
Yeah, that's I apologize for cutting off there.
I guess what I'm wondering is, because at this point, solar is still a relatively small amount of power produced, electric power, compared to coal. Like about, 10 or 15% of the electricity is produced through solar, whereas 30 or 40% is produced through coal. So the number of jobs per kilowatt hour is kind of interesting. Just not knowing anything else. We're doing a lot of work, employing a lot of people to produce a relatively small amount of energy.
So through the chair, to my understanding, but well, first of all, I unfortunately pulled this slide out, but I had a breakdown of generation, and the growth of solar on the grid continues to go up significantly. But for instance, coal in the grid decreased from 37% of the grid in 2012 to under 19% in 2022, while renewables produced over 23% of the grid. So the renewable space continues to grow while coal is on a decline. And you're seeing that represented in the jobs. That coal, you know, even in this slide alone shows a reduction year after year. You're seeing a lot of transition of coal workers into the clean energy economy because they see the potential. And, you know, I think people want to often look at renewables as the cause for that, but a lot of that actually was driven by natural gas prices and natural gas coming online over the last 10 years, and creating more opportunities in that space as well. But yeah, these are distributed projects, right? So when you are building and creating opportunities, they're distributed. They're not centralized. They would be like a coal plant or a mine. They are decentralized. So, you know, you've got to get out to Houston or these other facilities. In many cases, you can employ localized talent to do that work because it's much more cost effective than, you know, shipping in people from New York to come and clean your solar panels.
Right. I guess I'm thinking about it the other way and the amount of effort and the amount of labor to produce something. If jobs was the goal, we should go back to cultivating farms by hand rather than, you know, with a hoe rather than with a plow driven by a tractor. And it just seems that that's significant, that we're going to end up affecting the total supply of labor and the productivity of labor if you go to the economy scale.
So through the chair, I just respectfully disagree. I think what you're seeing is growth in a burgeoning job market opportunity around clean energy, that as these things are being built, I mean, they're being built in record numbers every year, while you're not seeing coal plants being built in record numbers every year. So as that begins to stabilize and you have more and more solar on the grid, yeah, there'll be less folks having to maintain those projects over time. But, you know, you're seeing a lot of deployment. Is jobs the pure goal of this? No, not at all. But is it a positive piece of the story that there are a lot of opportunities for folks to enter the job market in the energy space? Absolutely. And I would argue that what has really transpired over the last few years is we're no longer looking at things like renewables, specifically solar and wind, and pretty soon energy storage. I would include hydro in there as well. There's no longer alternative energy. These are mainstream energies and mainstream energy jobs that have been created. And I'm okay employing people, honestly. So if we can put our dollars to work to employ folks to run our clean energy farms, I would support that all day long.
Mr. Powers, please continue. Thank you.
So the next slide I want to show is just a graph or a map of where we are working across the country, clearly in Alaska and Guam, Hawaii, but you know, in 26 states nationwide. And the reason that we are working in these states is because of the policy alignment to be able to deploy renewables in the state have been in place. So you see a lot of our work is in the Northeast, places like Colorado, California, growing in places like New Mexico, and in Virginia, in places like Minnesota. And they're going back to the earlier comments around community solar, the policy alignment to not incentivize renewables, but just allow them to compete at a level playing field have shown that they can not only compete, but they can win and grow the demand, the supply to support the demand. You have major companies going into states looking to do major things like manufacturing or data centers and requiring that the states look at things like RPSs so they can get the power that they need to operate their facilities. And that helps enable more growth in the market. But what's most important here is having policy stability, understanding what the policy landscape looks like, not just today, but out for the next 10 years, really helps bring, I think, the most cost-effective capital into your state, where if we were looking at, you know, the fear that certain policies are going to get pulled back in 3 or 4 years, we probably would, may not invest, but we would, you know, you would have very expensive, like, private equity capital come in to take that risk. And as a result, the cost of the power on the back of that project is going to be much more expensive. When you could have policy certainty with things like RPSs or net metering or other key clean energy policies that are working in a lot of other places, you can attract very, very, very effective capital to your state to help deploy projects, create cleaner power, as well as create jobs.
I see one dot in Texas, and I was just wondering, can you give us a little background about the energy, the ways they try to incorporate renewable energy in Texas? And, you know, I see one dot, and I just say, well, I'm a very sunny state. You would think, you know, maybe there's a lot of solar arrays down there. You might even think they have a lot of breeze, so they'd have some wind farms. And so I'm just trying to give us a better idea of why we see one dot. Maybe you guys haven't invested much time in it, or they haven't called you or whatever. Just a little background on the one dot in Texas.
Yeah. Well, Texas is a, through the chair, appreciate the question. Texas is a unique state because of the way that they function from a grid perspective. So I want to point out that there is a lot of renewable energy in Texas, a lot of wind farms, really burgeoning solar and storage industry there. So why have we not invested there? It is a state, going back to the policy comment, it is a state where the policy changes dramatically. And we sort of, many in the industry refer to it as Wild West. It's just a place where you can take a lot of risk and get a lot of reward, but having good, stable certainty, it does not exist in Texas. If you follow what goes on in energy at all the last 2 years, Texas had massive crashes to their grid. People were freezing to death in places like Dallas, literally freezing to death because they were shutting down the grid. Companies were pulling out because they couldn't get stable power. ERCOT, the Energy Regulatory Commission of Texas, is its own country per se, and they don't follow any of the broader energy regulatory rules. And as a result, they've created their own marketplace. And it's actually, I would argue, has been a relative failure in terms of broader opportunity, and they're trying to fix it these days. So why don't we invest there? Because we are investing in, for instance, life insurance money, right? And we don't feel certain that an investment in Texas is really going to pay off. Now, I say that we're building right now the largest landfill project in the country there, outside of Houston. We do have a project there right now. So we are doing some there for sure. But we don't see the opportunities there as much as we see in other states.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate the answer. Please continue.
And then I just want to talk about, the next slide, our relationship with renewable energy IPP. So the term IPP is basically just a term of ours. It's the independent power producer. So clean capital technically can be called an IPP if you want to call it that. this 100% came out of my relationship with Isaac. I've known Isaac for a long time, been amazed at the work he's doing, creating an ecosystem in Alaska. He introduced us to Jen and her husband, who you see in the picture there, Jen Miller and her husband, who Isaac mentioned were former BP engineers, and they really loved the potential of what solar can bring both to decentralized communities. So you don't need to run major transmission wires to get to a solar panel in a decentralized community. You can bring that power up close, as well as the work it's doing to help solve the climate crisis. So we've worked closely with Jen and team. We've helped fund their growth as a firm and are actually investing in the projects that they are developing. The one we've talked about today, and we'll talk more about, is Houston. That is a very exciting project that is really breaking ground sort of as we speak in the summer of 2023. It's creating, as I mentioned, 30 to 40 construction jobs while it's being developed, and have certain maintenance jobs in the back end as well. Once it's operational, it's going to power enough clean energy for over 1,400 homes and really helping stabilize energy prices and diversifying the energy generation in Alaska. The borough for the project is located as a wildly key supporter of it, and I give credit to Jen and team for helping to get folks to understand why it's important to the community. But I think it's a model of what can be done in other places in Alaska as well. This is the first of a series of projects that Jen and team will be building. We have over 200 megawatts in a pipeline with them, many of it in the next sort of 2 years. You know, these projects aren't built overnight. They take time to develop the land, time to develop the contractual arrangements, to make sure the utility is able to handle the power. It's a very patient process. And then once the capital starts to flow, it goes into everything from buying the projects to building it and then maintaining it over time. We provide the financing and we'll be the long-term owner. And, you know, through my relationship with Isaac, you know, we decided to actually take an investment in Jen and team as a company as well, because we're very excited about the growth of what they're doing. They're tremendous leaders and, you know, are really passionate about the opportunity. We see the Alaska market as very exciting. The potential to really utilize the distributed energy model, if incentivized and structured correctly, can help bring power to communities that have been running on things like diesel generator microgrids, for instance, or other structures for a long time. But it just really is about how things are structured. We would love to help you work through some of those challenges so that we can help bring more capital to the state, create more opportunities, and more energy security overall. So I really thank the chair for the opportunity to speak. Happy to talk more about any of this, but that concludes my presentation.
Mr. Power, I would just want to know, if you would, Clean Capital is the investor here. Who is the owner of this project?
We are.
You are now the owner of this project. So you own the land also?
That's a great question. In this case, I actually don't know. I can get you the answer to that. And the reason I say that is it actually is, there's a bunch of different models for this. So in some cases, we'll work with a farmer and we will lease their land from them, and they'll have a 20-year or 30-year lease payment associated with the project. They don't want to sell the property, and we don't really care to have to own it. We just want to make sure we have a stable place to put the system and run the power. And in some places, we do own the land. In places like Minnesota, for instance, they're doing a lot of work with what are called agrivoltaics, where they're working with the farming agriculture community and then making sure that these solar panels have pollinators put underneath them, which is helping to attract bees, for instance, right? And you're finding communities where they are rotating crop to get higher yield around the solar system, because the pollinators are being attracted to that. So there's a really great way to think about sort of an ecosystem around these systems themselves. So, but to ask your question, I'm not sure if we own the land on this. I can find out. You know, we look at it in a variety of different ways. And according to Isaac, it is a lease from the borough. We're leasing the land from the borough, which is pretty common.
So in the interest of chicken or the egg, which came first, I'm wondering, okay, you come along and you invest and you you put the project in place, and the gentleman before us, Mr. Vandenberg, made the connection to connect you to who? Where was the need before you came along for Mr. Vandenberg to connect you to who had the need? And I'm trying to understand the nucleus of this.
So, Isaac, you can correct me. First of all, through the chair, thank you for that question. And I'm going to sort of just step back and explain where I think hopefully this will help folks understand better, like, Launch Alaska's role versus Clean Capital's role. Right? Launch Alaska is helping to develop companies, right, and investing in companies, hoping those companies will grow and scale. And that is sort of a venture capital or private equity type of investment that people are making into the companies themselves. Clean Capital is an infrastructure investor for the most part. We are investing in assets. So we met Jen and team through Isaac because they were looking for certain capital to come into those projects. And then as we have this conversation with them, we really like them. And then in many cases, Clean Capital will put rocket fuel or corporate capital into a company to help them do things like hire a bigger sales force or get the engineers they need so they can grow the corporate side of what they're doing while we're investing in the assets themselves. And the assets themselves, to go back to your chicken and egg question, there's a variety of trigger points along the way of a project that really need capital. Early development is usually a low capital thing. It's like finding a lease with the community and then finding someone that can contractually buy that power. That's a lot of sweat equity. But once you had to start buying equipment, doing interconnection studies, engineering, you know, aligning the substation, that is a serious capital injection. And that's where we come in and can provide that capital as a project is maturing and growing. And, you know, almost like, you know, it's a very much like commercial real estate, right? It's like you go in and you find a piece of property and, you know, someone's really working up all the permits and getting things aligned with the city. And then an investor will come in and really sort of grow, build, and own that those projects. So Clean Capital will be the infrastructure play. Launch Alaska has been the private equity piece to help Jen and team not just invest in them as a company. What Isaac's team does so well is it helps mentor them, right? So Jen and her husband are coming off of, and as someone who started a startup myself, when we started Clean Capital, there was five of us. Four founders and an intern, you know, understanding how to build the company, dealing with accounting, you know, figuring out, you know, how to run a board meeting, all those different things that the experts at Launch Alaska help coach these companies to do so they can become more mature companies that can attract better capital and really grow and scale and do the things that they do well. Like I think what Isaac has done well with Jen and team is really let them loose to do that. They do develop projects and help shepherd us into the conversation to bring them very cost effective capital.
Mr. Vandenberg, you have some input here?
Yeah, just adding on to what John is saying, to your original question, Representative Rauscher, this came about literally because I sat on a presentation with Jen and her team were making early on in their project. And I was just so impressed by her team and the project. And she, at the time, was pretty forthcoming about, you know, this is a good project. We do not have investors yet. And we do not know how we're going to finance this yet. And so literally after the presentation, I approached her and said, I think there's people who would love this project and would love your team. And let me help put you in touch. And that was really our role in this project. That's how it came together. And I would also just continue to sing the praises of both the John, you know, the Clean Capital team and Renewal IPP. John's phrasing is right. We really just cut them loose. They were, as soon as they got the financing, they were just off to the races, and they are an incredibly organized, well-run company already. And so, yeah, just a good local firm.
Chairman, if you don't mind, I want to step out of Alaska for a second and take Launch Alaska somewhere else where if people talk a lot about Silicon Valley, and what happens in Silicon Valley is you have an ecosystem of investors and venture capitalists and others that if you want to start a company, it's really easy to go around and find folks that are going to invest because they have an ecosystem of folks that are used to it, right? That is very uncommon across the country. In a place like Buffalo, that's wildly uncommon. So groups like Launch Alaska, or in Buffalo, we have something called 43 North, helps develop an ecosystem for those founders to be able to find both capital in that community as well as external capital that knows and can invest into opportunities. So there's a lot of discussion today is innovation moves away from the coasts, right, into the heartland and into places like Alaska. And, you know, it takes, you know, when if I'm an investor and I know Isaac's there helping bring this firm along, it means a lot to me knowing that, you know, they have some folks to rely on that can help them think through and shape both their business model and their execution.
Well, any more questions for the gentleman on Teams? Well, I thank you very much, Mr. Powers. I thank you very much, Mr. Vandenberg. Appreciate the information here. I want to thank both representatives today for sharing their expertise and giving us a better understanding on how capital for energy projects is raised and is acquired. And I also want to thank everybody for attending the meeting today. Our next meeting will be Thursday, April 13th at 10:15 a.m. We will be hearing that Green Bank bill from the governor on Thursday. Now, after the presentation, I'm planning on letting you all have till Monday to get your amendments in for anything on that. And we plan on moving it out of committee on Tuesday, but there also will be public hearing on Tuesday before that happens. Just so you have an idea of what we're doing, where we're going to be headed here on Thursday and Tuesday coming up. So if there is, I see no other business conduct, I am going to adjourn this meeting at 11:54.